announcement before we begin. There will be no class on Wednesday. We will have class on Thursday this week. So if you show up on Wednesday and there's no one here, you will know that you have made a mistake. Okay, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with these true, maybe not necessarily uplifting, but true confessions and all of that that Solomon has to deal with and that he has recognized through his own experimentation and through life itself, we might say. As a matter of fact, we could probably call this Lessons of Life Learned the Hard Way. But that's the way most of us learn, probably, anyway. We probably tend to learn things hard way more times than not. Again, it reminds me sort of when we were studying Genesis that you look at Abraham and you think, well, I'm not much like him. And you look at Isaac and you think, well, I'm not much like him. You look at Jacob the idiot and you think, yeah, it's more like me, Jacob. Jacob did it the hard way. Jacob had to figure it out his way. He wasn't just going to listen and do, you know, what he was supposed to do. He had to do it his way. And his mom was no help, horsey woman. That's another whole issue there. We'll get into that one. But horsey woman giving you advice, bad to listen to. As a man, you know, don't bother with that. But the whole point is, you know, she's going around undermining, you know, Isaac behind his back with Jacob, which doesn't do any good. And ends up, of course, losing. Part of her discipline was she never got to see her son ever again in life once she did all this. She died before he ever made it back. So, again, these are lessons of life. These are things that people figured out in the Bible. The wiser people than you and I, in fact, like Solomon, have figured out that none of this works. These are essentially things that don't, matter of fact, we could probably title this book, Things That Don't Work. And don't bother trying them because you're wasting your time. So here again, we are ready to resume and move on with verses 12 through 14. Rereading that, so I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. Again, maybe I missed something, but then he looks at it again and says, no, I didn't. Again, wisdom, insanity, and stupidity. Because what the man who will come after the king will do is what has already been done. And again, depending on how you want to look at this, I don't think it materially changes things in that he's saying the future is just going to be a simple repetition of the past. That the person who replaces me will do nothing more than any other king has done and will do nothing more than I have done. And in fact, at a certain level, he won't even live up to Solomon's reputation, of course, because no one ever did, no one ever could. But can you imagine this? I mean, imagine your existence. You're the king of the world, essentially. Everything's at your disposal. Everything's at your command. You can do anything you want. And you have money, time, and no pleasure should you withhold from yourself. And Solomon didn't. And at the end of it all, well, you think, well, God, that'd be kind of cool. Would it? Well, he says it wasn't. But people tend to think this way. People tend to think that if I could do this, if I had this or that, if I could go here or there. My guess, knowing Solomon, he said, I build houses for myself. I'm supposing he had a house, you know, we might say a house in Vegas, you know, a house up in the mountains, a house at the seashore. I'm sure he had houses any place a person would want a house. I'd like to go snow skiing from time to time. Okay, well, let's build a house in the mountains, and then we'll go up there in the winter. I want to fly fish. Okay, well, we'll build up there, and then you can fly fish. I want to go deep sea fish. All right, well, we'll build one on the Mediterranean. But I got a rule from Jerusalem, so obviously you got to have a big house there. I mean, and a house fitting only of Solomon, no less. The greatest king, as it were, wisest that ever lived. And so you have all these things. And people think, you know, this is why they buy timeshares. Well, I can have a house in anywhere, essentially, for 2 weeks a year. Well, Solomon didn't have them for 2 weeks a year. He had them all the time. And they were always there if he wanted them. He could always go do it. There wasn't anything to stop him other than his own volition telling him, well, you know, maybe don't do this, or I got things to do. Maybe his responsibilities might have slowed him down at some level. Responsibilities do tend to slow us down from time to time. And but other than that, he just did whatever he wanted. And any king after that, probably going to do the same thing, more or less. So I saw that wisdom, now that I've considered all this, I figured out, that I observed this. This is true. Wisdom excels stupidity as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I know, again, not still mentioned yet, nothing about death, but he's alluding to it. I know one fate befalls them both. Okay, well, we stop here at point 11. Again, the translation by Crenshaw is acceptable, but I do believe these terms have their own particular nuance that is not to be missed. 12 here, the first term, hololuth, madness, is used to denote the irrational mental aspect of insanity. This forms the state of madness or insanity. And people are insane if they're not in touch with reality. It's just that simple. Now, whatever form their madness, their insanity might take, some people are delusional. They're just not in touch with what's going on around them. Some people don't want to be in touch with what's going on around them. And so they withdraw into this world of their own making. Again, this is the type of person that just says, if I think it, it's right. It's not right just because you think it. You are not God. You are not a law to yourself. But there are people out there, and many people, in fact, that's the way they live their lives. They're a law to themselves. They're not going to be governed by doctrine. They're not going to be governed by a pastor. They're not going to be governed by any authority. They're going to just be a law to themselves. And guess what? You think that'll make you happy? Try it. It won't. It's not going to happen. And the reality is, of course, unfortunately, the pastoring aspect of the local church is, in my opinion, the less pleasant of the things that you have to do. The study part is kind of fun. But when you're pastoring, you're dealing with people. And strangely enough, for whatever reason, God decided to name us pastor teachers, not teacher pastors. So the primary emphasis is on the shepherding aspect of a local church, of determining decisions, making direction, making policy, and all that. And as far as I've ever been able to figure out, the chain of command runs from the top down, not from the bottom up. And so you can blow all that off, but it's not going to get you anywhere. You're not going to win in the church age with that, because of this dispensation in which we find ourselves. It's called the church age for a reason. It's characterized by the adjusted local church, comprised of believers that are pursuing the truth to the exclusion of other things at some level. And again, even within all that, there has to be priorities made. There has to be, people have to make decisions. So again, you have these issues that you have to deal with. It's part of life. It's just part of the job. You have to deal with it and move on. But the reality is, again, nobody has any problem with the pastor until he pastors them. Then he's an idiot. Up until then, he's fine. You know, and it's like the fundies used to say, you know, as it was, I remember this one time, this guy goes, well, you've done quit preaching and gone to meddling. Yeah, well, only if you pastor, then you're meddling. But, so you have this office, you know, you have this authority and all that, but you're not really supposed to use it. Well, and it's not towards believers anyway, because all believers got it all figured out, right? No, apparently not. Apparently that's why we're here. So this idea, this insane idea that you can just do it on your own, if you could do it on your own, then fine, go do it. But the reality is the New Testament's pretty plain, you can't. It's an insane idea. There's a certain insanity to that. So, and that's why we're, of course, exhorted, Hebrews 10:25, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together and all that. But people irrationally think they can do that and they're going to be okay spiritually. No, you're not. You're insane. You're completely the opposite of what the New Testament teaches. And yet, you think you're normal. Well, 13, the second term here, sikluth, folly or stupidity, denotes that which comes from those that lack moral or spiritual sense. It covers behaviors that stem from fear, proceed from rash decisions, and or demonstrate distorted values. Again, I've met these people. I know many of them. They're rash. They make quick decisions about important things. And they make these rash decisions. And they say, I'm going to do this. That's just stupid. I mean, that is stupid. Slow down. What is the big hurry? And I always kind of wonder myself. I mean, I've been rash when I was younger, so I know whereof I speak. I'm not speaking from someone who's never failed. I'm speaking from someone who's done this sort of stupid stuff. And I've made these rash decisions. And I found out, generally speaking, what I've learned in the Christian life is that slow and steady gets the job done. What's your hurry? Where are you going? Where's God's plan going that's all of a sudden in a big hurry? If I've observed anything about God, it seems to me that he acts pretty slowly. I mean, from our perspective, at any rate. I don't see God just quickly, you know. If God flew off the handle, well none of us would be here, would we? I'm sure we've all done stuff to make God fly off the handle, but yet he doesn't. He deals with us in grace and patience and tolerance and gives us time and all that. Well, I see these rash people. They want to make a decision. Got to do it now. What is in such a big hurry that has to be done now? When does God's plan get into this sort of crisis mode that I missed? That's got to be handled this second. Rash decisions are stupid. David made a rash decision back there to number the people. And guess what? It was stupid and it got him under discipline. So rash decisions probably aren't good. Again, decisions based on fear aren't good. Oh, I'm afraid of what's going to happen. What are you afraid of? What's the worst that can happen to you? They kill me. That's the worst that can happen is they kill you. And then what happens? Well, I go to heaven. Okay, well, that's about as bad as it can get then. So what are you afraid of? So fear and all that. And again, the people with distorted, twisted values, they've got these weird ideas that they pass off as the truth, and bad decisions stem out of that. Stupid actions. So 14, in this case, Koheleth is using the method of seeking to understand and interpret something by comparing and contrasting it with its opposite. 15, he introduces his reason for investigating the concepts of wisdom, madness, and folly more carefully with the causal use of the conjunction key, which is translated here again, because. And that is in here because, well, the New American Standard translates it that way too. Because what? So why am I investigating this? And okay, well, what I found out is, this led me to this conclusion, the people aren't going to do anything any different than what I've done at a certain level. 16, while the text is uncertain and difficult, ancient versions are not in complete agreement as to what the original actually was. There are only a couple of possible translations. As with many, if not most textual issues, the possible translations do not affect any doctrine. Furthermore, and any pastor worth his salt would know this, you don't use these problematic, difficult, obscure passages to try to prove doctrines. That's stupid. That is absolute insanity to use a difficult, obscure passage to try to prove your point. My guess is you don't have a point to prove if you're using that. And so I've seen people do this. This is my proof text, and they cite some obscure passage. And the reality is the passage is obscure. It's up for interpretation. It's up for debate. Don't build your doctrines on that. Build your doctrines on the plain sense of what the text says. And things that can't be argued with. You can't, you know, especially if you know there's a textual issue, it'd be stupid to build your doctrine on that. So again, these shouldn't be used as proof texts when attempting to document a particular principle. I won't use this verse as a proof text for anything. What do I need to prove that I have to use this verse and this verse only? There's nothing that I can think of, no doctrine I can think of. 18, the first translation indicates that the successor to Koheleth will do nothing more than Koheleth intends to do in his course of study, indicating that his successor will not exceed the depth or breadth of his investigation. So the second translation here is not much different and simply understands the final verb as a passive. They have done it would be the equivalent of it has been done, which indicates that any successor will simply investigate things as others before him have done. And actually, again, spending some time on this, the idea also here may be that any king that follows Solomon is only going to do what kings themselves have done. And maybe that explains the change to the plural there. They're only going to do what's already been done. They're going to do what kings do. Well, you know, however kings ruled and did the things they did in their time, that's all these people in the future are going to do. They're not going to go beyond that. They're going to just, you know, make decisions, build monuments to themselves, again, do all the things that typically we know kings did. But in any case, the whole point of all of this is the future's not going to hold any answers either. They're not going to figure anything out more than what he's figured out, is the idea here. They're not going to go beyond him in terms of any of this. So 20, in either case, Koheleth is indicating that he intends to deal with these matters in an exhaustive fashion and provide a final conclusion that will effectively end further need for research. So we can study the book of Ecclesiastes and what we'll figure out. Well, these are Solomon's conclusions. Now, he starts back sort of at the beginning, gives you his conclusions first, then tells you how he got there, then works his way through it, and then, of course, finally concludes with his advice now. Now, his advice now isn't that the voice of the old Solomon that's writing this book doesn't appear that much in this book, strangely enough. And when it does, he uses imperatives. That's one of the ways you know he is speaking, as it were, the older, wiser Solomon is speaking. He'll use imperatives to give you commands. Say, hey, look, I figured this out, do this. And you'll see that, for instance, if you turn to chapter 5, you'll see that he starts in some cases, and he doesn't do it all the way through the book even. He's not what we might call consistent, I guess. And so you start out with these imperatives in chapter 5. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God. In other words, you better be careful. You better stop and think about what you're doing. And draw near to listen. Come to Bible class, shut your mouth, pay attention, focus. You might learn something. Rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they're doing evil. I got some advice for you. Sit down, shut up, and learn. How's that for advice? Well, aren't you kind, Solomon? And yet the reality is, this is reiterated in the New Testament. What's James say? Quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Don't be hasty. Another imperative. Don't be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. You better be careful. You don't know what you're dealing with at some point. You better recognize that God's in heaven and you're in earth, and he has a completely different perspective, and his perspective is better. But as we know, we've all probably been stupid in the presence of God. Oh, God, I know thus and such. And God's like, yeah, whatever. No, you don't. So when you make a vow to God, don't be late in paying it, verse 4. He doesn't take delight in stupid people. Apparently stupid people don't honor their word. So here the idea is, when we do hear him talking, and very much his imperatives are going to have to do with God himself. He's going to talk to you about what I figured out. When he does talk, the older, wiser Solomon does talk and weighs in, you're going to find that he spends most of his time talking about God and how to relate to him, which the older, wiser Solomon had figured out. Hey, you better, as he says there, he sums it up, I think, in chapter 12, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Youth is fleeting. The prime of life goes fast. For some of you, it's going by even as we speak. Prime of life's not going to last that long, trust me. Those that are older know that. They've lived through it. They've seen it. Oh, wow, it goes by fast. It goes by quick. So, again, here the idea is that nobody's going to do anything more than Solomon. Nobody's going to surpass him in this. 22, some interpreters see a specific reference to Rehoboam. And that would be the one who comes after the king, obviously, would be his son. That's the first successor to the throne, whose behavior would eventually divide the kingdom. But it seems more likely at this point it's just a general reference to anyone that would attempt to deal with these issues after Solomon. So 23, although Koheleth will assert that earthly wisdom is vanity, since it provides no advantage in death, he will concede that wisdom does have advantages over folly in the short term. So there, we might say, okay, what's the long-term benefit of wisdom? Nothing, you die anyway. Well, what's the short-term advantage of wisdom? Well, it has the benefit of giving success, for one thing. It's better to be wise than to be stupid. It saves you a lot of wear and tear and a lot of trouble and a lot of scuffed knees and all that, stubbed toes and all the things that would go with stupidity. So 24, the idea is that wisdom only has a relative, temporary advantage over folly. But that advantage is only good while one lives. I mean, once someone is dead, what's the advantage of being wise? Well, there wasn't any, I guess. You died anyway, didn't you? Sure. But, so, now the argument becomes, if you stop and think about it, what's the logical conclusion to all this? Why bother? Why bother with wisdom? If wisdom has no real advantage, why bother? But he is going to acknowledge that wisdom does have a temporal advantage. It's better than stupidity. So 25, although he does acknowledge wisdom is superior to folly, he will later acknowledge that intelligent conduct may not always produce a desirable result. Chapter 2, verse 21, when there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he gives his legacy, the idea here is his inheritance, he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. So it appears that he is suggesting that, number one, anyone that wanted to be involved with what he was doing should have been working with him. And by this time, we certainly know that Rehoboam was old enough to have done that. But yet, apparently he didn't. But Solomon recognizes, even though my son didn't do anything of any of this, he's going to get it all anyway, essentially. And whether he'll care for it, whether he'll have capacity for it, or any of that, really doesn't matter, does it? Because I'm going to die and I can't have any control over it. And so the idea is, if you can't control it, well, what's the point of it? And also, chapter 9, verse 11, he deals with this. So Solomon's a realist. He's neither an optimist or a pessimist. He's a realist. And he points out here, I saw again under the sun that the race is not always to the swift. And the battle is not always to the warriors. And neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. It's a certain crapshoot out there, isn't it? Who knows what's going to happen? You can be, you know, smart. I saw one of the things that, you know, there's this email going around. It's attributed to Bill Gates. Bill Gates didn't write it. It's 11 Rules of Life or something. Somebody sent it to me. But it said, life isn't fair. The first rule, life isn't always fair. No, it's not. It's not always fair. It doesn't work that way. And the reality is, and his last rule was, be nice to nerds. You'll probably end up working for one. He didn't write it, but still, it's funny. So, guess what? You could be the 97-pound weakling, as it were, and you went to school and studied and got stuff, and you happen to be ahead on the curve. Or you can be LeBron James and get paid millions of dollars right out of high school to play basketball. But guess what? He's just one injury away from never playing again. And the reality is, life isn't always fair. It doesn't always work out the way you think it will. You would think, well, the bigger guy, the stronger guy, will always win the fight. No, not the case. I've watched people. I remember when Mike Tyson was in his prime. I mean, people, they would get into the ring and they were just looking for a place to fall. They didn't really want to fight him because they were scared of him. Well, there came a point at which that persona cracked. And then suddenly people weren't afraid of him. And the biggest, strongest guy didn't always win. And then sometimes, you know, you'll go in, especially if you watch the heavyweight fights, one guy might outweigh the other guy by 40 or 50 pounds and be much stronger, but yet he doesn't win. Why? Because he's not as skilled at certain things. And so it isn't always the biggest, strongest, smartest guy gets it all. It doesn't work that way in life. And Solomon acknowledges that. Okay, well then, so why try anything? Again, this begs the question, why bother? If it doesn't work out this way, then why bother? And the idea is, well, you got two choices. You can either adopt the why bother attitude, the why bother approach, or you can say, well, maybe there's something more here than meets the eye. Maybe there's something I haven't thought of. So 26 here, Koheleth now compares the opposing ideas of wisdom and folly with the opposites of light and darkness. 27, wisdom, the divine viewpoint of life, is found in God's word and is often linked to the concept of light. Psalm 36:9. Again, passages with which I believe he would have been familiar. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light, we see light. And the light comes from God, obviously. It comes from His Word. Psalm 43:3. Oh, send out your light and your truth. Again, the idea of light here is linked with the concept of truth. Darkness is linked with the concept of ignorance or lies or faulty viewpoint. So is ignorance, lies, stupidity, is that better than wisdom? No. Wisdom's way better. Just as light's better than darkness. Psalm, what would we have there? 43:3. Send out your light and your truth and let them lead me. Bring me near to your holy hill and to your dwelling places. And then Psalm 119:105. Bible pages sticking together. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. This is where enlightenment comes from. This is where knowledge comes from. This is where the ability to function comes from. And you're not going to find it anywhere else. So 28, folly, on the other hand, represents the extreme path the foolish choose, the stupid. And it will eventually lead them into utter darkness. Proverbs 5:23. And the reality is that everybody's walking a road. Everybody's making a path. Everybody's making choices. And bad choices put you on a bad path. And if you walk on a bad path long enough, you're going to come to a bad end, trust me. This is the way it does work in life. Proverbs 5:23, he will die for lack of instruction. In the greatness of his stupidity, he will go astray. Proverbs 12:23 also. And that's the immoral man. That's the person that's stupid enough to engage in adultery and all of that. And that's going to lead to a bad end, whether people admit it, acknowledge it or not. Again, it's promoted in our world as fine. The Bible says it's not. Proverbs 12:23, a prudent man conceals knowledge, but the heart of idiots proclaims stupidity. And you got people, and they got a lot to say, all right, but how much of it's really wise? How much of it's really sound? How much of it's really doctrinal? I listen to a lot of people talk. So much so, sometimes that I don't even want to listen anymore. But you can't adopt that attitude. You have to still listen. And people have a lot to say, but how much of it's really to the point? How much of it really matters or accomplishes anything? Proverbs 13:16. Every prudent man acts with knowledge, but an idiot displays his stupidity. Do you have to know if he's an idiot? No, you can just watch him. Just watch him long enough, you'll figure it out. It won't even take long, probably, because he'll show you pretty much what he is. I've talked to people, given them the divine viewpoint, had them just sit there and look at me like I was from another planet. I'm talking about believers, not unbelievers. Unbelievers think you're from another planet anyway. But believers, you stare and you spell the truth out to them, you give it to them, you document it from the Scripture, and they just look at you like, what? No, I'm going to go this way. Okay, fine. I've done my best. I got a clear conscience. Go kill yourself. I don't care. If that's the way you really want to go that way. I don't care. At a certain point, you just have to adopt that attitude. It's their volition. If they want to do it, let them be stupid. I don't care. Be stupid all you want. And you'll find out that stupidity will not get you ahead in life. And it doesn't get you ahead with God. Proverbs 15:21. Folly. Stupidity is joy to him who lacks sense. Some people actually rejoice in their stupidity. They think it's fun. Well, let's be stupid. This is fun. Well, you find, you know, out playing chicken on the railroad tracks or, you know, whatever they're doing. Oh, this is fun. Let's jump into this water. We don't know how deep it is. We don't know what's underneath the surface, but let's jump head first. That's stupid. That is absolutely stupid. They don't bother checking out their environment. They don't bother figuring out what's going on. They just go out and do their thing. And to them, this is fun. This is fun. This is the way to live life. Yeah, it's fun. I like being stupid. Being stupid's fun. Well, good for you. I don't. A man of understanding walks straight. Again, suggesting that the stupid person, the person that engages in folly, doesn't walk straight. They walk a very circuitous path, a very crooked path. Well, 29, any thinking person should recognize that light is superior to darkness, since it illuminates the world and allows one to see clearly. 30, in that regard, wisdom is superior to folly in that it allows one to face the realities of the world in an intelligent fashion. See, some people don't want to face the world in an intelligent fashion. They want to stick their head in the sand. Well, stick your head in the sand all you want. It's not going to change the world. You may be oblivious to what's going on around you, but the reality is some of us have to live in the real world. And you'd be wise to live in the real world and acknowledge it for what it is. And not make excuses for people. Oh, well, they're stupid, but they can't help it. Yeah, they could help it. They could make different decisions. If you deliver a fool, guess what? You're only going to have to do it again. He's still going to be a fool. It's not going to change. And so the reality is you have to look at the world and you have to face it for what it is. It's an unpleasant place sometimes. We're in the angelic conflict. We're at the very tail end of the angelic conflict. The demons have invaded this country. The forces of darkness rule this world pretty much. And for the believer to act like, oh, well, we're all on the same team. No, we're not. Absolutely not. No, we're not. I wish we were. It'd be nice. But we're not all on the same team. Oh, if you're a believer, you're fine. No, you're not. Just because you're a believer doesn't mean anything. It means you're going to heaven. But you can be the dumbest believer on the planet and still go to heaven. You can be the most foolish believer in the world and go to heaven. There's wise believers and there's foolish believers. And foolish believers, in my opinion, aren't getting ahead in life. It's not going to work for them. And you got to be able to face this world and look at it. No, it's not always pleasant. No, it's not always nice. No, it's not always pretty. But the reality is, if you can't face the reality of it, how can you deal with the reality of it? And the reality of it is, we live in the Laodicean church age. We live in the voice of the people. We live in, quote, Western Christianity has become democratized. The Bible doesn't advocate this nonsense, but Western Christianity does. The church isn't a democracy. Like it or not, it's not a democracy. But Western Christianity is, essentially, has become that. And that's what Laodicea means. The voice of the people, the right of the people, the will of the people. And what's this church say? Jesus said, I just want to puke you out of my mouth. You make me sick. I feel like vomiting when I think of you. Well, I would prefer to adopt the Philadelphia model of a church. The church of brotherly love. And so you have to face the reality. We live at the tail end of the church age. People are negative. They're going negative. They're getting worse day by day. The world's getting worse. The cosmos is deteriorating, degrading. We're talking about it on break. You look at the change in television in the last 30 years. Or even 40 or 50, for those who go back that far. And you see this reflection of what the world's become and what it is. I mean, every show now, you got a fag on it. You got a lesbian somewhere in the movie. But you can't have a show anymore without a homosexual. But, you know, back when I was a kid, we called them queers. Oh, you can't do that now. They're gay. Happy. Not hardly. And this is the world you live in. And it's getting worse. And you better face it. It's getting worse. And believers are getting worse. The church is headed in the wrong direction at the end of the church age. As Bob Dylan put it, the bride is walking backwards. And that's the nature of the beast. That's the way it is. But if you're, you know, again, I would opt for the Philadelphia model. The church that Jesus doesn't have anything bad to say about. Because they're pursuing the truth. They're making the applications. They're making the sacrifices. And they're the ones promised, of course, the pre-tribulation, pre-wrath deliverance. And obviously all the church is going to get it. We know that. But still, they at least have capacity for it. Average believer out there, do you think the rapture really means anything to the average believer out there, the Methodist, the Presbyterian, the Baptist? You think they're really thinking about it that much? I am. So again, to face the world, you're going to have to deal with the realities of the world the way it is. The world's a bad place. Sorry. I didn't create it. I'm not the one that made it. I'd like to change some things myself, but a certain level, what can you do? So again, wisdom allows you to deal with that, to face it, to see it for what it is. Just like light allows you to see stuff for what it is. So 31, Koheleth summarizes his approach about the superiority of wisdom by contrasting the wise person with the fool. And you got those two types. I mean, obviously these are extremes. You got the really, really stupid person and you got the wise person. And there's everything in between, we know. But Koheleth, interestingly enough, or Solomon, as he writes all this, he tends to deal with extremes and blacks and whites. You know, he only talks about the wise person and the fool. Well, isn't there a lot of ground in between that? Yeah, sure. And isn't there a lot of ground between light and darkness? Well, sure, but these are the extremes. And he tends to write about the extremes. Because he's trying to set up these opposites to show you that, look, they're opposite for a reason. And which one do you want to tend towards? Do you want to tend towards stupidity or do you want to tend towards wisdom? I would rather tend towards wisdom. So 32, he states that the wise man's eyes are in his head, which is designed to communicate that he is perceptive. He can see the world clearly. He has discernment and is thus able to make sound decisions and manage his life well. And again, apart from discernment, if you can't discern what people are, you're going to be taken all the time. You're just going to be a walking, talking idiot yourself. You have to recognize what people are and see them for what they are and not be snowed by them. I've met many, many believers that talk a good talk. They know all the words. They can talk doctrine, this and that, but where are they? Where's their application? Where's their level of adherence to the godliness code? You know, you can talk a good talk all you want, but they don't tend to walk the good walk, and that's hugely different. So it doesn't matter how much doctrine you quote know. What bottom line is where the rubber meets the road is how much do you apply. And if you don't have discernment and you can't see people for what they are, and that's not always pretty. I mean, it's not always pretty seeing people for what they are. Sometimes you wish they were different. You wish you could change it, but you can't. That's their life. That's their deal. So, but the wise person, he has to deal with this stuff. And so why does Solomon say, as he says there at the end of chapter 1, in much wisdom there's much grief. Why? Because you can see things clearly. You're not snowed by all this. And so you're able to make better decisions. You're able to manage things better. And it's not always pleasant. It's not always pretty. It's not always fun. But I would rather have that lifestyle than the idiot who's just out there blithering along, doing his thing, calling it God's will. I mean, I've heard all kinds of things about what God's will is. Yeah, well, you better be able to actually discern what it is, not what you want it to be. And sometimes, unfortunately, why do we have these commands like humble yourself under the mighty hand of God? Because God's will goes against us. And we have to deal with that. And we have to acknowledge it and say, you know, God's wiser than I am. He's smarter and he's more powerful. And I'm going to humble myself under his hand. I'm going to let his hand call the day, not me. And if you do that, you're a wise believer. And you may not, on the surface, people may say, well, you're not getting ahead in life. You're not doing this. You're missing out. No, you're not. No, you're actually probably living life. So 33, on the other hand, the fool walks in darkness, which indicates he orders his conduct without the benefit of actually seeing the world. And this is obviously a formula for disaster. And you look at people and their lives are a catastrophe. They're a disaster. How did they get to be a disaster? Why? They've rejected wisdom. They've rejected doctrine at a certain level. They've rejected the light. They didn't like the light. Why? Because the light went against them. As he said there in John, the light has come into the world, the true light that illuminates every man. And yet the world's rejected it. Why'd the world reject it? Well, John chapter 3, I believe it is. John 3, 18. Well, everybody should know John 3:16 by heart. You ought to be able to quote that one for me. I mean, this is the first verse you learn. God didn't send his son into the world to judge the world. Not at the first advent, verse 17. No, he didn't send him in to judge the world at the first advent. Now, he's going to send him back to judge the world, but not right now. Not at the, that will be the second advent. But that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. This is the judgment. That the men love the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light because their deeds were evil. And the light just shows them up for what they are. And I've watched people chafe under Bible doctrine. I've watched them sit in class and just chafe under it. Couldn't stand it. Just chafe. Just look on their face was just God-awful. Why? Because the truth was going against them. And if it goes against you, well, you have to acknowledge the wise man says, well, hell, that went against me. Okay, that went against me. And so they end up as a disaster. Why? Because they reject the truth because their deeds are evil. It shows them up for what they are. Obviously, in the phase one sense there in the world, they reject Jesus Christ totally because they don't want to see, they don't want to have to acknowledge man isn't good. Their little philosophy, all men are good, we're brothers under God. Well, Jesus Christ kind of tends to discourage that thinking. And so believers sit there, and they're not happy. They're not applying doctrine. They're just whatever they're doing. And they're miserable under it. When you're miserable under the truth, the problem isn't with the truth. The truth is the truth. When you're miserable under the truth, the problem's with you. Let's face it. So again, the wise man, the fool, walks in darkness, can't really see what he's doing, can't really know what he's doing. And he's going to make very bad decisions. And eventually, at some point, of course, it's going to cost him. 34, the contrast is between the wise who are able to successfully navigate this life with the fool who cannot effectively handle the issues that confront him in the here and now. And those issues aren't always easy. They're difficult sometimes. You have to make hard choices. Very hard choices. I've had to make very hard choices. But fortunately, I had the doctrine, the wherewithal, the wisdom, the prayer to think about them. Pray about them, and then make them. And you have to make them sometimes. At some point, you got to do it. So 35, one should not be aware that the fool is not the one who is mentally deficient. He is not someone who cannot learn the truths of wisdom. It's not because he's dumb. He's not a fool because of a lack of intelligence. He's a fool because of a lack of positive volition. There's a huge difference. So 36, rather, he is someone that chooses to operate apart from the principles of wisdom, since he refuses to listen and learn the truth. 37, in some cases, the fool is one that does not even acknowledge the existence of God. Psalm 14:1, while other fools are aware of his existence, but simply ignore his plan. Psalm 14:1 sets forth the concept. Of the interior thinking, the internal thinking, the thought processes of the fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So anytime you meet a person that says, you know, there's no God, I'm an atheist. No, you're a fool. You're an idiot. God exists, whether you like it or not, you're just an idiot. Another term for atheist, synonym for atheist, idiot. And also here, other fools are aware of his existence, but they just ignore him. They just pretend that they can do it any way they want to, and that God's not going to intervene or act. Romans 1:21-22. And this is these are the definitions of negative volition. At a phase one level, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And for the believers at a phase two level, even when they're aware of it, sometimes they blow him off. Romans 1:21-22. For even though they knew God, in other words, they recognized him. They acknowledged there was a God. They did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Well, here we go again with the light and the darkness motif. Professing to be wise, they became morons. Moros in the Greek, actually. You can transliterate it. Oh, they became morons. Oh, they're wise, so they think. They became stupid. All the while proclaiming their wisdom and how smart they were and how oriented they were. Well, they're not. 38, the fool is one that does not properly fear God, and he demonstrates his arrogance in any number of ways. Ecclesiastes 4, 5. One of the things you can say about fools is fools are lazy. You see a lazy person, you're looking at a fool. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. And we'll deal with that when we get there. The fool's lazy. The fool doesn't really want to work. The fool wants to make money without working. Well, I guess good luck in this world with that one. If you find out a place where that works, just let me know. Because I want to sign up for that one. A place to make money without working. No, it doesn't work that way. Ecclesiastes 10:3. Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking. And he demonstrates to everyone that he's a fool. You don't even have to watch him very long and you can figure it out. You know, he's probably the kind of guy that his hat falls off and he reaches over and kicks it while he's trying to pick it up. Stumbling along like an idiot. And you can see it. You can see he's an idiot. And they demonstrate it. It's overt. You can see it. Acknowledge it for what it is. This person's a fool. They're stupid, spiritually speaking. Ecclesiastes 10:14, yet the fool multiplies words. A lot of fools got a lot to say. No man knows what will happen, and who can tell what will come after him? I like these people that make pronouncements. We call them sportscasters, weathermen. What's going to happen tomorrow? It's going to rain. Oh, it didn't rain. You're a fool. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. All you can do is give a best guess. That's all you can do. And we call these prognosticators people that are going to tell you what's going to happen. Well, we'll see what's going to happen. But they demonstrate it. Proverbs 14:1 also. So nobody knows about tomorrow to speak of. You know what's going to happen tomorrow? Well, about the only thing I can tell you is the sun will probably come up in the east. It'll probably set in the west. Will it rain? I don't know. Will it be hot and sticky? Probably. It's hot and sticky today. Chances are good for about the next, 6 months? It's going to be hot and sticky. Proverbs 14:1, the wise woman builds her own house, but the foolish woman tears it down with her own hands. The idea here is the woman that doesn't know how to order herself in her own household. You have to deal with that. Proverbs 29:9. When a wise man has a controversy with a fool, the foolish man either rages or laughs, but there is no rest. I've seen that demonstrated. You just aren't going to win with some people, so you're best just, you know, make your statement of divine viewpoint and move on. Let them rage, let them laugh. I don't care what they do. They're still fools. But you won't get it resolved. Because the fool doesn't really want it to be resolved. And he certainly doesn't want it to be resolved for the divine viewpoint. Men of bloodshed hate the blameless. But the upright are concerned for his life. A fool always loses his temper. Watch these people with their real problems with anger. I don't know any man that doesn't struggle at some level with anger. But over the years with doctrine, you learn to moderate that and you learn to get on top of it. But I've seen people, they never learn to get on top of it. They're bitter, angry, unforgiving people. They're fools. You can see they're fools. I mean, that is the classic definition of a fool. So, The wise man holds it back. Hey, okay, I'm not going to fly off the handle here. It's easy to do. We've all done it. And that's not just men. Obviously, women can do it too. But the reality is, what good does it do you? Does it get you ahead in life? Does it solve the problems? I don't think it does. Well, 39, the fool rejects the principles of the truth, the sound principles, and ignores the good advice that is made available to him, which leads to disastrous results. Proverbs 1, 20 through 33. And our time is up. That's a lengthy section, so we'll just stop there and take this up on Thursday so we can learn more about the fool and how he rejects good advice. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.